From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in West Menlo Park.
Haight-Ashbury.
I live in the Western Addition.
Bernal Heights.
San Bruno.
I live in Pacific Heights.
Coming up, a woman pushes for change within the Catholic Church by becoming a priest.
Though they do not proclaim that women are secondary, in every action, they live it out.
Then we'll hear from a man whose calling is to care for the dying.
He was absolutely cured of his mental illness. He was still dying of cancer, but he became a sage, if you will.
And we take to the streets with an artist whose work memorializes the violent deaths of Black and brown people.
These people matter, the people that are being portrayed in these designs. This is my contribution to the movement.
Paying tribute today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. We start today with our series, The Spiritual Edge, stories at the intersection of innovation and belief.
I'm a Muslim.
I am a Jewish.
I have no religion.
I'm Christian.
Reform Judaism.
I'm Catholic.
Muslim.
Not religious.
Buddhist.
Southern Baptist.
Hindu.
Atheist.
Christian.
Agnostic.
Catholic.
Pope Francis assumed the Vatican's top position only 2 years ago, but already he's been widely heralded as a progressive reformer. He's presented himself as a pope of the people who's committed to the poor. But about women, specifically women priests, what little he said has kept in line with conservative Catholicism, which forbids the ordination of women. In 2013, Pope Francis said the issue was closed, but an independent movement has helped about 200 women worldwide to be ordained as Catholic priests or deacons. Many now lead small egalitarian congregations, a style of worship they say is a return to Christianity's roots. KALW's Judy Silber tells us about one San Francisco congregation and its woman Catholic priest.
In the dining room of her San Francisco Victorian home, Maria Eitz shows off her priestly attire, a beautiful red embroidered stole.
It was too long, and so we had to cut it. But then it was too short. So we put on beads and bells.
The bells are a flourish. Usually Catholic priests wear robes. But during Mass, this simple stole is the only garment that distinguishes Eitz from her community. Considering everything else, her wardrobe is a relatively minor deviation. The Vatican bans all women from the altar. Yet Eitz is a woman who 2 years ago became a Catholic priest.
The Catholic Church has a hierarchy, and the hierarchy is totally male-oriented. Though they do not proclaim that women are secondary, in every action, they live it out.
Tired of waiting for change, an organization called RCWP is helping women to ordain as priests or deacons. RCWP stands for Roman Catholic Women Priests, and since 2002, about 200 women worldwide have gone through its training program. The church does not recognize the ordinations. Officially, the women are excommunicated. Eitz says she doesn't care.
The power that I'm interested in is the love of God and the love of people. How can they take that away? How can they say we are not part of that?
RCWP and the women priests claim to be as Catholic as the Vatican. To this point, ordinations follow strict church protocol. At the same time, the women are rewriting the liturgy and altering some customs. They stress inclusion. In California, 10 women priests lead communities, including one in San Francisco called Sophia in Trinity.
So could we rise and begin our service?
It's a Saturday morning, and 15 people stand in a circle to sing. Maria Eitz wears her red stole. The rest drape silk ribbons of red, blue, and green around their necks. Of course, most Catholic communities meet on Sundays, but Saturdays are when this group can pray here, at St. Cyprian's, an Episcopal church. No Catholic place of worship will let Eitz lead under its roof. The service is quiet and mostly serious, but not heavy. Eitz leads without much fuss. She asks others to read. At times, she invites participation.
As we tell each other our names, Let us also add a gift that we wish to give to the world today.
My name is Peter, and my wish for the world is to forgive ourselves and each other for our mistakes in the present.
Peter, who did not want to give his last name for personal reasons, is a 31-year-old tech worker and recent transplant to the Bay Area. He grew up in what he calls a middle-of-the-road Minnesotan suburban Catholic community. He wasn't looking for a woman priest, just a progressive church. He now drives an hour every other week to worship here. He says it is expanding his notions of God, and he still feels Catholic. Others agree. Joan Mininger knew Eitz before her ordination and followed her.
It's not that I left the church. I've never left the church. We are the church. But it's important to do something that counteracts what we don't agree with.
The Vatican invokes tradition to defend the rule. Jesus, they say, appointed 12 apostles, all of them men. That wasn't an accident, says Father Ilo, a priest and administrator for the Catholic Star of the Sea Church in San Francisco.
The church understands that to be normative, that Jesus didn't choose just 12 men because it was a custom of the time, or he wasn't thinking very clearly that day. There's a reason he chose only men, and that's his call, not ours. So the church doesn't feel itself authorized to change that tradition, that example that he set.
But Eitz says that logic is stifling. For her, it stomps on the way she understands God. It loses a message of love that she has worked hard to cultivate. Eitz was born into Hitler's Germany. She lived with her grandmother until after the war, when her mother showed up and brought her to an orphanage. Miserable, Eitz watched the sun set over the ocean each day.
I would stand and I would howl my anguish into the sun as the sun would go into the ocean.
At the orphanage, she discovered she had a way with kids. And so, during the Cold War, she helped smuggle children from east to west. A young woman at the time, she fell in love. Her boyfriend was Christian. Until that point, she'd had little contact with religion. The two would argue about God. Still, returning from her East German assignments, she would head straight for the church where he played the organ. Then, for political reasons, he was killed. Fearing for her life, she left the country and went to England. She didn't plan on ever visiting a church again, but not too long after, she passed an old village chapel and entered. She noticed something odd about the large cross that hung inside. Jesus was missing. After that, it all gets fuzzy.
The last thing that I remembered was I was clinging to the altar, staring at that empty cross.
Next thing she knew, she was in bed, sick, dreaming vividly. She can't quite explain it, but afterwards, she began to believe in a God of love. Soon after, she came to the United States, and while working at a hospital, met a Catholic priest. He baptized her. This was in the 1960s. It was the era of Vatican II, a time of liberal reform for the church. She loved it.
It was just wonderful. You know, I didn't care actually much about the history of the church and, you know, dogma and all of that. The sacraments mattered to me, and the New Testament and the Old Testament.
She got a master's in theology, helped Vietnamese refugees, and then set up a long-running center for troubled children in her home. She raised 4 adopted kids. All that time, she was a practicing Catholic. But over the decades, the church was undoing Vatican II's reforms. That bothered her, as did its attitude towards women. In 2009, she joined a group with a woman Catholic priest. 2 years later, the group urged her to become ordained. She was in her 70s.
I was unable to sleep. I slept in increments of 20 minutes here and there.
She told God she needed a sign. The next morning, she went out for a walk. On the sidewalk, she saw a hopscotch pattern. She got excited.
It's a cross, except you see it as a cross that, you know, I've drawn many times for the kids to play on.
It wasn't just any old hopscotch. on it was sketched a woman with outstretched arms, like Jesus.
So we take this bread as Jesus took bread and give thanks for this wonder of God within us.
AIDS is now part of a movement that is putting in place its own reforms. Messages of love and inclusion trump tradition. God is no longer a he. During a usual Mass, it is a priest who offers the bread and wine of communion. But here, AIDS only starts the ritual. Bread and wine are passed from person to person before she gives a final blessing.
May we wisely follow the star of light within us now, and enact faith and hope and love in the world.
Amen. Amen.
For AIDS, the authoritarian church has lost its way. The rules of tradition are a blockade to love. And for her, love is the true message of Christianity. Her rebellion from the Vatican is just an effort to return to that. In San Francisco, I'm Judy Silber for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. And now another story from The Spiritual Edge and their collaboration with StoryCorps Legacy, which collects the stories of those living with serious illness. When someone's dying, sometimes the best medicine isn't medicine at all. And sometimes what needs to be healed isn't the body, but the mind. That's the kind of caretaking that Paul Kelly takes pride in. When Kelly began his career as a hospice worker in 1983, he knew instantly that he'd found his calling.
For some reason, I can't fix my toilet at home. You know, I can't fix the car. I can't do bookkeeping. I can't do computers. But I can be with somebody who's dying for some reason and their families. I rarely make a mistake. Mr. Chu would be a good one. He was a man who came to us about 1999 or 2000, and he grew up in China and learned calligraphy and painting, and he became a master. And then they had the Chinese Revolution, and he's no longer allowed to do calligraphy, and they sent him off to teach math or something. And he became mentally ill, and he would be a patient at the Chinatown Mental Health Clinic, and he would go every day. Very taciturn guy, didn't say much. He just sort of frowned. Then he got this ulcerating stomach cancer, and he came to us. I learned that he was a calligrapher and so forth, and so I went to this store and bought some, it's like a toy, how to do Chinese calligraphy, and I brought it in. He's just staring at me. So I think maybe day three or four, he kind of went like, huh. He kind of laughed at me a little bit. Maybe a day or two after that, he just grabbed it and began to do calligraphy. And I called his cousin, and she brought in like real equipment, real brushes and real papers, and he just unloaded reams and reams of this calligraphy. And people who knew said it was like he had memorized Shakespeare. It was the stuff that came from ancient and was all just out. And we thought, God, wouldn't it be kind of cool to have an art show? Because he had like so many things. And so we got like tons of it framed. And we invited people from the mental health clinic. And they couldn't believe it was him. He was absolutely cured of his mental illness. He was still dying of cancer, but he became a sage, if you will.
That story is part of KALW's series, The Spiritual Edge, in partnership with StoryCorps Legacy. It was recorded at Zen Hospice in San Francisco. For more stories from The Spiritual Edge, go to KALW.org and click on Cross Currents. Not all death is natural, and not all death is cathartic. If you've walked the streets of the Bay Area recently, you might have seen posters featuring the names and faces of Oscar Grant, Renisha McBride, Mike Brown, and Trayvon Martin, among others. They're plastered across building walls, store windows, and telephone poles. The simple black and white posters are meant to honor the lives of unarmed black and brown people who've been killed, and they're made by the Oakland-based artist Ori Original. KALW's Todd Whitney tagged along with him in San Francisco's Mission District for a night of wheat pasting the portraits onto every available surface.
We just finished wheat pasting a poster on a trash can here, and we totally did not notice a police officer walking the street. I was almost about to book it, man. My name is Ori Original, and I'm a visual artist who is originally from Los Angeles, now residing in Oakland. Up until recently, I've been doing more digital designs, specifically with my current project, Justice for Our Lives, which is a portrait series of people that have been killed by police or vigilantes. So tonight we're going to be walking around the mission and try to find some spots to repaste some posters. I have some Mike Brown and Eric Garner prints. If a cop sees me, of course I'm going to run. I'm pretty agile, so I could get away, and I've ran many times in the past. So I'm thinking of hitting up that light box over there that's on the corner. Usually you would want to start off with applying the wheat paste onto the wall and then pasting the poster on top and then applying the wheat paste on top of it again. What inspired me to work on these designs was the situation that was happening, Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, when George Zimmerman was not found guilty for killing Trayvon. That's sort of the time when the Black Lives Matter movement began. When I did the very first design, I was coming back from the Oscar Grant Memorial that they have at the BART station every year. So I was inspired to do a portrait of his and to just share online. And so I incorporated the Black Lives Matter meme into it. I posted it online and I got a pretty good response. So I want people to know that they're able to use these images whichever way they want. Whether if it's in the streets, at protests or demonstrations, or even artistically, like wheat pasting or whatever it may be. So the portraits that I do are very simple. I pull up an image on a Google. So I usually use the more iconic images that are shared of these victims. And I upload it onto Photoshop, and I pretty much trace it. The images that I've been doing are black and white, so I don't add any color or much design to them. And that was so that people would be able to alter these images a lot easier, as opposed to if it was an image that has a lot of layers to it, then it would be a lot more difficult to work with the image. And another reason is because I'm profiling people that have been killed. So these are also our ancestors, and I like to depict that with just black and white. I know that there's people that do have issues with seeing these posters out in the streets, because I've passed by some of the ones that I've posted where people have torn off certain parts of the poster. Like, they would take off the black and the part where it says Black Lives Matter, So this is pretty much a similar approach where I'm bringing it to people's faces whether they like it or not. I have met the families of some of the people that I have profiled. The first family that I've met has been of Alex Nieto. Alex Nieto was shot and killed by SFPD while on his way to work. He was a resident of Bernal Heights. He grew up in the neighborhood, I believe. We had a printing party out here in the mission, and Alex Nieto's parents came unexpectedly, and they were there printing with us. It was kind of surreal to see a mother and a father having to print an image of their dead son. It's something that no parent should ever have to do. Whenever I see people holding up my artwork, like at the Millions March or at other protests, it makes me feel like the work that I'm doing is fulfilling its purpose. I feel that it's the reason why people are using these images is not because of the talent that I'm infusing into these designs, but it's the names of these people and the stories of these people is the reason why people are using these images. These people matter, the people that are being portrayed in these designs. This is my contribution to the movement.
That was Oakland-based artist Ori Original, and that story was produced by KALW's Todd Whitney. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. And now it's time for the book report, brought to you by the Litography Project.
Ah, the Litography Project!
Shh. Your guide to the literary Bay Area.
For the book report, we ask Bay Area writers to tell us about a book that's meaningful for them. Today we hear from Catherine Ellison, a writer in San Francisco.
My book report is on Lucky Jim by Kingsley Amis. Lucky Jim is the story of a man who is trapped in a life that's not of his choosing. The protagonist is Jim Dixon, and he's in a job that he hates. He's getting sucked into a relationship he doesn't want, and he's being completely passive the whole time about it. And his only defense is to make these funny faces. So he'll make faces at the people that he hates. He'll make his shot in the back face, or his lemon-sucking face, or his sex life in ancient Rome face. It's a dark humor in a lot of ways. I mean, a lot of humor is dark. It makes you laugh at the absurdity or tragedy of life. And in most cases, when you find yourself laughing along with Dixon, it's because he's about to get hit by a car or some terrible person is taking advantage of him. And yet the way that Amis handles it is quite artful. You feel incredible empathy for Jim Dixon. He's like every man.
Dixon was alive again. Consciousness was upon him before he could get out of the way. Not for him the slow, gracious wandering from the halls of sleep, but a summary, forcible ejection. He lay sprawled, too wicked to move, spewed up like a broken spider crab on the tarry shingle of morning. The light did him harm, but not as much as looking at things did. He resolved, having done it once, never to move his eyeballs again. A dusty thudding in his head made the scene before him beat like a pulse. His mouth had been used as a latrine by some small creature of the night, and then as its mausoleum. During the night, too, he'd somehow been on a cross-country run and then been expertly beaten up by secret police. He felt bad.
You know, this is a book that describes life in rural Britain in the 50s, and yet people can identify very easily, I think, with the protagonist because I think so many of us have had feelings of being trapped by life and not being able to get out of circumstances. He does a lot of things that would probably frustrate you, but in the end, other people realize that he's a good person and he becomes more of a good person.
That was San Francisco writer Catherine Ellison talking about Kingsley Amis's book, Lucky Jim. This book report was produced by Nina Gensler-Debs for The Litography Project. And now we'd love to hear from you. What's your favorite book and why? Email us at news@kalw.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW, or call us at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hambrick, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Liz Mack, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. The line producer was Sandhya Dirks. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And this music is by the San Francisco band The Dodos. You can hear them live on Wednesday night at the Great American Music Hall in the Tenderloin. Music starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. It's